Hi everyone, and welcome to the final episode in the fourth series of My Inspiration, a podcast series from HMV. In this podcast, we give musicians, actors, filmmakers and producers the chance to take a welcome break from talking about themselves and instead talk about their greatest inspiration. I'm your host Tom Goodman, and I'm delighted to welcome you to the finale of our fourth series. Our guest today, and for the final time, is Jamie Cullum. Though he's been grafting away since his early 20s, Cullum shot to fame in April 2003 when it was revealed that he had signed a multi-album deal with Universal for £1 million advance. His first album for the label, 20 Something, was a huge hit and became the number one selling studio album by a jazz artist in the United Kingdom, as well as elevating him to become the country's biggest selling jazz artist of all time. Mixing his live sets with covers from the likes of Massive Attack, Pharrell, Rihanna, Pussycat Dolls and Radiohead, as well as his own originals, Cullum's open approach to jazz saw him win many new fans for the genre and has seen him collaborate with the likes of Pharrell and alt-punk's idols. As well as his own recording career, which has seen him release 7 studio albums, Cullum has presented a weekly Tuesday evening jazz show on BBC Radio 2 and has worked on the soundtrack for films like Gran Torino and Meet the Robinsons. His latest effort is The Piano Man at Christmas, his first festive collection. Recorded over 5 days at Abbey Road Studios with producer Greg Wales, the album features 10 new tracks from Cullum, all with a Yuletide tinge. We spoke to him about making a Christmas album, recording with a huge orchestra, and his inspiration. How's it going, all right? How's the campaign?
I think it's good. Yeah, it's going well, actually. Had lots of great interviews and feedback and all that kind of stuff. I've been chasing my tail a bit in a family situation this morning. So it's like, I'm just trying to think if I've managed to get my kids to school on time, managed to forget half the stuff that they needed, had to go back and all that kind of stuff. So it's that's the other side of life.
Yeah. It's your fun and games.
Yeah.
So The Piano Man at Christmas, it's a Christmas record. Have you always wanted to do a Christmas record?
I don't know the honest answer to that. I think probably I did, but I never felt ready for it. I love the way Christmas music makes you feel at Christmas. If it's good, if it's done well, and it's beautiful songs, Christmas music is really brings the Christmas vibe, and some of the great Christmas songs are some of the most beautifully written songs of all time. So it's definitely a genre, if you like, that I've always held in really high regard. And I think in the last 2 or 3 years, it's something my wife told me I should really do. She said, why don't you, we'd listen to Sufjan Stevens every year, which we love, listen to Ray Charles, James Brown Christmas album, a couple of other kind of Christmas compilations. And my wife said, you should do one. And I was going to do it either this year or next year. And then when the pandemic hit and our touring got cancelled, I thought, well, I may as well do it this year.
It's 10 originals. Normally with a Christmas album, it's one or two and then a lot of classic covers. Was that important to you that it was all originals?
Yeah, it was, because the covers thing has been done so well by many people, you know, particularly if you think about what Robbie's just done. He obviously did originals as well, but what Robbie's just done, what Michael Bublé has done, I don't know, Rod Stewart, they're out there, and they're amazing. And it's not that I didn't think I could add to that and do a good job kind of in comparison. It's more, it didn't feel as exciting to me to do, okay, so how are we going to make this different? How are we going to make it mine? All that kind of stuff. What felt exciting was digging into the songwriting of it, because, you know, go back to what I said earlier, you know, if you think about a song like Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas or Santa Claus is Coming to Town, we feel it implicitly as something that makes us feel Christmassy and almost like a novelty song. But there is a reason they've lasted so long. And the reason they've lasted so long is because they are impeccably written songs. White Christmas, you know, this is Great American Songbook, classic style songwriting. And that kind of stuff I get really nerdy about. I go into nerd land and pick it apart and go, well, why does this work? What's, you know, how does this chord change work? What is it about it? And I thought, well, if I could apply all that knowledge and nerdiness to my own Christmas songs, which is what I tried to do, then that would be really interesting to me. So yeah, that's why I did it. It's not to say I would never do covers, but this just felt like the most interesting pathway.
And how was the writing? I mean, did it all come quite quickly, or have these songs been kind of coming over a period of years? I mean, when were they written?
They were 95% of it was written between March and May.
Okay.
This year, yeah. So I had ideas in my notebook for the last year. So I had like a few title ideas. I had the bones of the song Beautiful Altogether, possibly last October. Around the time I started working with Robbie, I had a couple more other ideas because I was on his Christmas album last year and that was very inspiring to me. So I started noting things down in my notebook. But once I got into the zone, once I got into March and I was really like, I thought, well, maybe there'll still be a few covers. Maybe I'll write four. And then suddenly I'd written five. I wouldn't say it was easy, but once I was in the headlights, it really started to flow. And I just loved, I mean, I could have added more, to be honest, but I had to record it then, you see. And I really wanted it to come out this Christmas because I just know it's going to be it's such a weird time for us all. It's like, I'd really love to have something out, trying to spread some joy, you know?
Yeah. I mean, how was it getting yourself in the mindset? I mean, recording in March to May, I mean, did you have to go full Brian Wilson and build yourself a little grotto? Or
I don't really believe in that, you know. So the thing I did do was listen to quite a bit of Christmas music. So I made a playlist of my favourite ones and just kind of listened to them for a bit to kind of really decide what I loved about them. That was the first thing I did. Second thing I did was I reread that beautiful book of Christmas poetry that Wendy Cope wrote, which I love. I reread the short stories of David Sedaris, his Christmas stories. I don't know if you know them, but he's a brilliant writer who writes amazing kind of diary, kind of memoir stuff. And he used to work in Santa's Grotto as he was the elf. He's a short guy like me. And I really was like, yeah, I could totally see me being hired as a Christmas elf as well. So I love those stories. They're so funny and they're so sad and joyful. And I thought, well, if I could write Christmas songs that were joyful, but also maybe a bit melancholy and also a bit fun and all those things, like bring that richness of Christmas like he does with his short stories, then I'd be onto something, I think, that was worthwhile being out there, you know.
Yeah. And then Abbey Road with a 57 piece orchestra, I mean, yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah, it was I mean, that was the true Christmas present to me, being in the best studio in the world with the best musicians in the world playing these arrangements. It was it really sent shivers down me. It's the most fun thing I've ever worked on. And I think because the writing was done in a short period of time and we recorded it in 1 week, it was 4 days really. It came together so quickly once it was on the road because we just had everyone who was the best at what they did in the room. And it was mind blowing. Yeah.
I mean, was the nature of it recorded so quickly because, you know, when you've got 57 people in a room, you have to get stuff done because getting them back together, you never know.
Yeah, I mean, there is that. But I think also the nature of that type of music is that if you prepare properly, when you put this music in front of these types of musicians, you know, that they, you know, these are the kind of people that do all the film scores and all that kind of stuff. They don't need to play things more than once, really. They can, sometimes the first sight read is the best one they do. That's the level you're working with. When I say the best, it's not like needless hyperbole. It's like they're literally the best at what they do. So it's just, you kind of press play. And they just sound amazing. So really you're then just thinking about artistic decisions about style of performance and maybe changing a few things here. So quite frankly, if recording that type of music takes you longer than 4 or 5 days and you've done something wrong.
Is it completely overwhelming, that sort of experience?
It is. And actually you have to drag yourself back to reality because at some point you do have to make a decision about whether this trumpet solo was the right one or this trumpet solo or whether the sound of the French horns is right and stuff like that. And there are a lot of decisions to make in the moment. So you have to not allow yourself to be overwhelmed. But on many times I would just stand back and go, I can't, you know, this is, as I said, it's like the best kind of Christmas present I can imagine, writing music for these people to play, really a gift.
You must be gutted you can't sort of do some special shows for it.
Well, you know what? There is that argument, and of course I do feel gutted about that, but I didn't write this Christmas album for this Christmas. I wrote it for, I think the thing that is great about Christmas albums and Christmas music is that it should feel like something you get down out of the attic every year, like the decorations, like you kind of look forward to seeing. It's like, oh yeah, I remember you, you know? So you write it for 50 years. And, you know, I hope that, you know, these songs will be coming out into my repertoire every year, really. And you know, if people really love some of them, then they'll feel like that old decoration that you get out every year that is familiar and gives you that warm feeling.
So having got this in the bank now, obviously you're promoting it at the moment, but are you writing back for your next project, or are you kind of just focusing on this?
I mean, I'm definitely focusing on this, but I don't really find a time to write and say, now I'm writing. I guess I'm always picking away at something. I'm always tinkering. Saw a great video of David Lynch the other day, the film director, just building a sink on YouTube. And he said, he just talks about how he just like tinkers with stuff all the time. And I'm definitely like that. So yeah, I've got a few new songs on the go as well. Nothing set in stone yet, but yeah, there's some new things coming.
And I have to ask you about Idols, because obviously that record's just come out this year and it was a collaboration that I don't think most people would have imagined. What was that like?
Well, I love Idols. As I can guess by the nature of your question, you're a fan of their music. I think they're a brilliant band. I love what they stand for. I love their live shows. I love their records. I love their songwriting. I love Joe's lyrics. I think they're a great band. So I've seen them live a couple of times, and I got to meet them at the Mercury Music Prize the year I was a judge. And we just got chatting. He knew the band knew that I was a fan because I'd put their record on a compilation that I'd made, and they knew I was a fan. And I think what's great about that band is that there is an argument to say they were trying to subvert expectations, but also I think they feel a kinship with people who love making music, who are in it for the music and making connections with people. And I don't think it matters whether you're a classical musician or a jazz musician or whatever. I think they're very uncynical about that. And when I said, man, if you ever want to collaborate on something, I'm right here. There wasn't a look of shock. It was like, great, yeah, I'll give you a call. And a month later, he was like, we've got this tune. We've always thought it'd be really great to lead you into the song with a kind of a beautiful piano intro that takes you into the menace. I'm like, I know exactly what to do, because I knew their music intimately already. So, it was great. We sent stuff back and forth, and they were just, I loved how excited they were when I sent the piano part back. And yeah, it's, you know, I love doing stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, we interviewed Joe just before the album came out, and he spoke about that when he was a chef, he used to listen to your radio show while they worked. So yeah, it's a strange thing to come around like that.
It is. And I think, you know, the more stuff like that happens, the better. And I think what's cool about them is that they are cool because they care about being authentic. And I think that's cool.
Right. Well, we've got you here to talk about your inspiration. So do you want to tell us who you've chosen?
I thought about this. There's so many people I could have chosen. And I decided to choose Harry Connick Jr. because in some ways you might think it's obvious, given that he's a piano player, singer and works in jazz. But actually it's not obvious, because I think about kind of legends that it could have been Tom Waits or Ray Charles or James Brown or Tribe Called Quest or all the stuff that I've been really influenced by. But I think the reason why I chose Harry Connick Jr. is because I love him, and he's got a really interesting back catalogue. And the kind of questions I knew you were going to ask, I thought, well, there's some really interesting albums to point out that people who have never really given this stuff a chance might really want to have a listen to.
So how do you discover him for the first time? I think I read you were 14.
I think I was younger than that, actually. And a reason why I know is because I discussed it in an interview yesterday. I remember seeing him on, it was like Breakfast TV when I was probably about 9 or 10. I'm just looking to see when he was promoting the When Harry Met Sally album. Yeah, so he did the music for the When Harry Met Sally film, which came out in 1989. So I probably would have been about 9 or 10 when I saw him on, it was like TVAM or something with Anne Diamond. I don't know, it's on in the background while we were getting ready for school. And I didn't know much about, I'd heard jazz from my parents' record collection. I'd heard Oscar Peterson and Frank Sinatra. I'd heard Dave Brubeck. What else? Like George Shearing, Nat King Cole. I heard a bit of jazz. But, you know, at that time I was into, me and my brother were into Iron Maiden and AC/DC, really. But we had a piano in our house and I liked hearing the piano, but it always appealed to me in the sense that I associated the piano with older people and older style of music. And Harry Connick Jr., he was this young guy. He was obviously only in his 20s or early 20s, maybe, yeah, probably about 20, 21. And he sat down at this grand piano in TVAM and just did this. I'd never seen anyone play like that on the piano. And I just remember thinking he wasn't even singing, doing that croony thing. And he was wearing like a T-shirt and he wasn't like dressed up like a kind of old fashioned guy. I just thought, wow, that guy's amazing. So yeah, I remember seeing that and just being quite taken. I didn't like get the record or kind of become a fan instantly, but I just remember being, wow, this guy, who is this guy?
So when did you kind of get the first record?
So my brother bought me an album of his in 1994. And it was the album that a lot of people say kind of blew apart his career, but not in a good way. So he'd become huge for this big band jazz kind of sound, particularly the When Harry Met Sally soundtrack. He did the standard, "It Had to Be You," you know, really kind of croony Frank Sinatra thing. But actually what's interesting is that he is from New Orleans. So he grew up playing New Orleans style blues and jazz and funk music. And he made his first New Orleans kind of more funk kind of style record in the style of New Orleans bands like The Meters and like Dr. John and stuff like that in 1994. And that was the first album of his that I got that I fell in love with. So at a time when he's on the front cover of an album wearing a leather jacket and the kind of middle of the road crowd go to Albert Hall to see him play his big band jazz. And he turns up in a leather jacket with a Fender Rhodes and a Hohner clavinet and a wah-wah pedal and a New Orleans funk band. And, you know, I remember reading reviews at the time, like people were walking out, like storming out of the rooms, like, this is not correct. When for me, he made that album and I absolutely loved it. Around that time, I was listening to hip hop, drum and bass, Nirvana's Nevermind, Ronnie Size, Massive Attack. I was into all that kind of stuff. And then this guy turns back up into my life. My brother bought me the album for Christmas because he knew I'd like it. I fell in love with the rhythms and the musicianship and the weirdness of it. And I just thought he was cool.
What was it you think about that kind of attitude to a genre that spoke to you? Because, I mean, when you were first presented, it was in the same sort of style as someone who had all the traditional jazz trappings but didn't pay attention to them.
Yeah. Well, I think that was definitely something I got from Harry, for sure. It was something shortly after I got that album, I went with my mum and my best friend to the Shepherd's Bush Empire to see him play a show. So this was when he was doing the New Orleans funk thing. And I was right at the front. My mum and my older brother were sitting up in the seats at the top tier of Shepherd's Bush Empire. Me and my best friend, yeah, I would have been 14, 15 at the time. We didn't live in London, so we had to drive up to London, but I was standing in the front row and it was like, you know, and he was dancing and playing guitar and playing Fender Rhodes. And then he would sit down in the middle of the show, he'd done all this kind of New Orleans funk stuff. And then he'd suddenly play, you know, You Don't Know What Love Is by Cole Porter. And my thinking was like, here is someone with such a command of his musicianship that he is able to play something that feels like James Brown or like the weirdest kind of funk soul stew I've ever heard, but then sit and play a beautiful Cole Porter ballad in that very traditional style. And again, I just thought, what a disruption to your senses that is. And whilst I don't have anything like the facility that someone like Harry has at the piano, or even the kind of voice he has, I really wanted, when I came on the scene, I really loved that idea of just mixing up. Why couldn't you kind of play, you know, a cover of of all the rock bands I was into, you know, like a Radiohead song or whatever the thing I was playing at the time, along with these old songs and along with like a different kind of performance style. Because I'd seen Harry do it and I thought, well, it's all fair game, isn't it?
What was the crowd like at that show? Were you the youngest person there?
Do you know what? That was the amazing thing about it. No, it was all, certainly on the floor where I was, it was all young people, because all, I guess, the people that had fallen in love with this big band stuff had stupidly got scared off by the New Orleans funk show he'd done. Or he did half and half or something. I don't know. I don't even remember the story properly. But no, he had a really young fan base. And what I really noticed with that young fan base is that they were young people who were really interested in playing instruments, that wanted to hear people really playing amazingly on their instruments and playing and being able to dance. And I noticed that when I started playing, people would say, oh, have you got an old audience? And that, yeah, there were older audiences, but there were plenty of young people there who were interested in musicianship and the playing of instruments at a high level.
I mean, when you were first presented as, you know, late teens, early 20s, it was as this kind of, you know, this has never been done before, taking on all these modern songs. And I guess to you, it'd never been done in Britain, you know, it was new in Britain, but in America, it was not new at all.
Well, yeah, kind of. I think, I don't really know how to answer that, because obviously Harry wasn't like necessarily covering like kind of modern rock songs and stuff. I think I just at some point I decided to use my love of jazz and musicianship to just be like a springboard to take me wherever I wanted to go. And the thing that I loved doing the most was playing with other musicians and getting into a kind of headspace where you're jamming and playing, nothing's off limits. Because around the time I was signed, I was in two other rock bands playing in a band that was a bit like, I don't know, they're a real kind of Primal Scream kind of vibe, you know, like big, like long rock kind of, you know, mixed with kind of acid house kind of stuff. I was a backup keyboard player in like a pure pop act. I was singing in a James Brown covers band. I was in wedding bands. I was in jazz bands. So I was doing all this other stuff. And I think just at some point when I was presented, it was just, I hadn't like overthought that I'm going to do what Harry's doing. I'm going to do what anyone else is doing. I'm just like, I'm going to use my musicianship to do whatever it is I want to do. And as it happened, I was interested in all these other genres of music and I anchored it around the piano and my love of jazz.
How, in those early days when you first signed, I mean, how much did you kind of have to fight to be presented like that? Because presumably at any big label, there are people who have got a career path that is lucrative and safe and, you know, just go straight to that audience you were talking about, rather than doing all the experimentation. Was there any pressure to try anything like that?
There was a bit of pressure on my second big album. So I, after 20 something, which is my big kind of breakthrough record, I definitely felt like I wanted to rebel a bit from it. And that was the album that I made after that called Catching Tales. But generally, I think the success of my 20 something album, my Universal album, was such a surprise to everyone. Even the label, what they were hoping it would do well, but I don't think anyone thought it would sell 6 million albums or whatever it sold. You know, that was you know, throughout the world, America and in Asia and stuff. And I think because I'd followed my intuition and just done what I'd wanted to do, I think they'd thought, and they'd pretty much left me to my own devices ever since, really.
That's interesting, because when you speak to a lot of artists who get signed young, it's not typical.
It's not typical, but I think because I was operating outside of the pop machine, you know, that year I had 20 something out, I was collaborating with the classic kind of jazz people. And then I was also on stage with Pharrell Williams, you know, singing front end and doing all that kind of stuff as well. And I don't think I was overthinking it. I was just kind of following my nose, really, because I would, you know, for me, the Jazz Association, people who didn't understand jazz so well would always say, oh, it's for old people. And my experience of jazz had never been old, because I'd got into it through hip hop as well as like my mum and dad's record collection and other things. So I knew there was a whole load of people out there, the record collector kind of DJ, NBC sampling kind of crew were all into Miles Davis and Herbie Hancock and all that kind of stuff. It didn't feel old. So I think I just always found myself in interviews at that stage trying to justify that somewhat. But in terms of actually making the music, I just kind of followed my nose, really.
Yeah. Then going back to Harry, one of the obviously the marked things of his career is not only has he got a successful music career, he's also acted and presented and things. Mm. And your career has taken you in all sorts of different avenues with your radio show and collaborations with different people. You know, have you always wanted to sort of, you know, have that kind of broad career rather than simply behind Make Records?
Well, I think all the other stuff I do is all in service to making records, really. You know, I definitely don't act and have no desire to. And really my presenting of the radio show just totally feels like an extension of making records, because I think of myself as a fan. I became a musician because I was a fan of music. And if that sounds obvious, it's not, because I think a lot of people start out as a musician. I am a rabid, you can see on the wall behind me, I'm a rabid collector of music. I love listening. And I, you know, doing the radio show was merely an extension of what I was already doing anyway, which is like my PR were endlessly telling me to stop talking about other people's records in my interviews. It's like, well, don't forget to mention your own records. Like, the new Strokes record came out today, or, you know, don't talk about the Strokes. Like, what about a jazz record? All that kind of stuff. So the radio show, for me, always felt like a way to ask other musicians questions I wanted the answers to help me with the making of my own records, to meet other interesting musicians and just talk about music, which in its own way feeds back into the inspirational loop to making my own stuff. So yeah, everything is genuinely, I think, in service to my own record making.
But obviously that side of your career did also give you the opportunity to have a really good long sit down with Harry himself. How was that?
It was really amazing, actually, because I think because he's had such a long, amazing career, and his career has taken some different kind of avenues, and I followed him down all those avenues, and I have real genuine kind of intellectual curiosity in all those kind of avenues of his career that maybe he feels like hasn't been as looked at. I mean, you'd have to ask him, but I think he felt very understood by me because I'm a genuine fan, and I really love all those records that are the kind of deeper, far reaches of his back catalogue. And he said to me during the interview, "God, I never get the chance to talk about this stuff. It's a real pleasure." So yeah, and he was so sweet because I told him that his kind of musical career had made a totally huge impact on my life, and he said, "Well," he said, I hear young musicians say that about you." And he said, "It's a really, you know, to think that I had a part to play in your career just makes me feel really proud." So he's a genuinely lovely human being as well. He just radiates warmth and care and compassion. And he's a great family man. And I think he's to be looked up to in more ways than one. You know, I think he's genuinely a good person as well.
Because obviously when he had his Cole Porter collection at the end of last year, all the clips on Breakfast News and things were of him in Hope Floats with Sandra Bullock and, you know, the Harry Met Sally things you talk about. So do you think for a lot of people, he's just sort of frozen in that time?
You know, I think obviously there's an element to his career that because he's also been an actor and he kind of looks like a Hollywood movie star as well. And I think he's played that part very well as well. So I don't think he has like a bee in his bonnet about it, because there'd be no need. Because if you look at his back catalogue, like one record is a big band orchestra album that fits right in that kind of, you know, zone. And then the next one is the same thing, but like with the wackiest piano solos on and crazy arrangements. Then he'll do a trio album or a solo piano album or a duo album with Branford Marsalis. And then he'll do another funk album. And then there'll be one of his musicals. He's just a relentless kind of creative force. And probably doesn't care. And I think he's savvy enough to know that when he's on a big TV show, of course they're going to ask him about acting with Sandra Bullock, because that's what everyday person knows. And then he'll probably drop into a conversation about some obscure New Orleans jazz piano player. I've always loved that way he smuggled in like really some deep New Orleans cultural signifiers in like an interview on the most mainstream TV show you can imagine. And I always love, like if I'm on BBC Breakfast or like I'm sitting on the sofa with Lorraine, you know, I love dropping in something about Ghostface Killer or Idols or whatever, you know, smuggling that into those situations. It's it feels like a kind of good use of covert operations, you know?
Yeah. I mean, obviously he's slowed down a bit in recent years, but for a long time, he's incredibly prolific.
I mean, I think, from what I could gather, I think I wouldn't say it's kind of slowing down. I think he definitely went through a stage where he said to me he didn't want to travel quite as much because his daughters were, you know, young teenagers, and I think he wanted to be at home as much as possible. And I think, you know, that Cole Porter album coming out and touring the UK again was really, you know, his kids are grown up, they're leaving home, and I think he was like, okay, I can get back out there and do a bit more stuff. And I really admire that, because, you know, he was just spending a lot more time in America writing musicals and having a TV show, and just didn't take him too far away from home. And it's amazing to hear someone at his level saying, "I just wanted to be at home with my kids." It's like, good for you, man.
Yeah, for sure. So having seen him live first in Shepherd's Bush, have you seen him lots of time live since?
Yeah, lots of times. Yeah, in lots of different situations. But also the lovely thing is we've been on festival bills together. So we did a show at the same festival in Newport Jazz Festival a few years ago. So great to kind of be near him and around him on a kind of, you know, like a peer-to-peer level. That was like a pinch myself moment.
And we always ask guests kind of, what do you think the undiscovered gem is in his back catalogue? And obviously you made reference to the funk record. Is that the one you'd go for, you think?
No, do you know what? I could easily go for that one, but actually I've got another one for you, which is a 1997 album called To See You. And it's nearly all ballads record, but they are all original songs written by Harry himself, with lyrics of great depth, arrangements of. It's a very odd album. It's almost like, you know, when Scott Walker made those very kind of mainstream orchestral kind of what do they call it, like almost easy listening. And then he made those albums that were still in that zone of the easy listening sounds with the most out there music. I feel like this is Harry's kind of Scott Walker album. It's a very strange album that sits in the palette of the big band orchestral albums, but it's all originals and it's all very weird love songs. And it's an absolute gem of a record. It's a total gem of a record. And I don't think many people know it. And I think they get a lot out of listening to it.
Do you go back to it a lot?
I do, yeah. It's actually the one I wouldn't say I go back to a lot of those early albums. I listen to them so much as a younger man. I listen to his new albums, of course, because I'm always interested in, and I love him. But if there's one that I go back to that I choose to listen to, it's definitely this one. It hasn't dated in any way. It feels very timeless, but I think its weirdness is its strength.
And for the ultimate masterpiece, where do you tell people to go? If people want to start somewhere, or where do you think that is?
That's a good question. And one that is very hard to answer. I'm just looking at his back catalogue here. I would say you could start. He made an album in 1991 called Blue Light, Red Light. It's a big band record. Again, a lot of Harry originals on this one. And it's got a real sound of a traditional big band record. It's very listenable, but it's also got that it's got that eccentricity that he smuggles into this type of music that it'd be easy to say it's easy listening, but actually it's definitely not. What he's doing with the big band, his style of arranging, his style of piano playing, it's quietly subversive. And I think he's always managed to be quietly subversive. So that'd be a good place to start. The original When Harry Met Sally soundtrack is a good place to start as well. You get a good sense of who he is. So yeah, they'd be really, really good places to start, but you could also jump straight into To See You if you want to get your head into something meaty.
It's probably the most horrible name for a genre, isn't it? Easy listening. I don't know any artist would ever be comfortable with that.
Yeah, I know what you mean, but I think I've done enough nerding out on some of the subgenres within easy listening to know that, well, you know, Serge Gainsbourg could be classed as easy listening, and Burt Bacharach could be classed as easy listening. It's like Stevie Wonder has made easy listening records. It's like some of the greatest, most prolific and deeply gifted artists of our time have operated within that genre. I can see the association, but I think, as I said, I think I'm enough of a music nerd to know that it's a meaningless term, really.
So I guess the main, well, one of the main takeaways from Love of Him is don't fight it, subvert it.
Yeah, I like it. That's very quickly summed up. But I think the idea of smuggling little grenades of eccentricity into something that is easy on the ear is one of Harry's great strengths and something that I've really learned from listening to his music.
Well, Jamie Cullum, thanks very much for letting us hear your inspiration, and best of luck with The Piano Man at Christmas.
Cheers, Tom.
That was the final edition for this run of My Inspiration. If you'd like to check out our previous episode, which includes chats with Ian McDonald, James Bourne, LaRue, Pet Shop Boys, Luke Evans, May Martin, Big Nasty and many more, head to hmv.com/podcast. Or you can check out all the episodes on your regular podcast providers.